Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
March comes in like a lion and goes out like a library podcast on fire. Crystal and I get things burning with reviews of albums by Speedy J and Annie. It isn't the Annie you think you know. Amanda teaches us that even some TV was a book first when she reviews Kathy Reich's Deja Dead. Podcast newbie Jeremy reveals that some fairy tales are not just for kids via the very persistent Gappers of Fripp. All is ablaze when film geeks Bill and Clint review Night Moves and Regular Lovers.
I can't believe you listened to that.
If you made it to the main library in January, you probably saw the staff's favorite things display in the lobby. Brian, one of whose favorite things was electronic music, is yours truly, and it's true. I like electronic music. Techno jumped ship from Detroit to Berlin in the early 90s. It was in Europe that beats became fetishized, while Americans still thought it was cool to wear dirty flannel shirts. Joachim Popp, a.k.a. Speedy J, was a producer who rose above the avalanche of bedroom beatmakers to create music architectural in form but hip-twitching in function. In other words, it's arty, but you can still dance to it. That's the track Cream 3 from Speedy J's collaboration with Chris Leibing, Collabs 3000, Metalism. As you can hear, this isn't house music. This is techno, with a grotesque sans-serif capital T. There was a moment when the acid house movement had crested, and DJs wanted beats a little harsher, a little faster. They wanted sounds with a little more clank than the rubbery timbre of the Roland 303. The then preferred synthesizer of acid house producers. Collabs 3000 is definitely born from that moment. There's a reason this album is subtitled Metalism. If you liked the first wave of industrial music, but couldn't stand when that genre became a parody of itself, this is where your muse should turn. Check out the track Tunix. Collabs 3000 was produced by the original artists, but if you've a penchant for banging, the library owns some wicked DJ sets in the same stylistic vein. Check out Carl Cox's double disc Explosion Global and Danny Howell's Global Underground Miami, the latter of which features Simon Ratcliffe's soaring remix of Throbbing Gristle's classic Hot on the Heels of Love. So Crystal, you have some beats on your own to tell us about, right?
I've been revisiting an album I discovered a couple years ago called Annie Mall by the Norwegian artist Annie. If you're into Madonna, Kylie Minogue, or others in the dance and electro pop scene, you'll dig Annie too. Annie defines her music as pop with strange edges, sounds immediately listenable and utterly beguiling, mainstream and underground all at once. I define her music as unavoidable musical infection, without all the yucky coughing and sneezing. Annie began recording music in the late 1990s with her boyfriend Tor Korkness. After Tor's sudden death in 2001, Annie took an understood break. She eventually returned to DJing and writing songs. When her full-length debut, Annie Mall, came out in 2004, the buzz from music bloggers brought her into the spotlight. Although the album didn't achieve major commercial success, Annie scored major cred with the critics. The catchiest tune on Annie Mall is Chewing Gum. After listening to the clip, I think you'll see it could be a tribute to Violet Beauregard from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Other standout tracks on Annie Mall include Me Plus One, a friendly proclamation of triumph over her pop rivals, The Greatest Hit, a disco-fueled tune co-written and produced by her late boyfriend, and The Dreamy Heartbeat, a song about discovering love on the dance floor. Annie Mall is guaranteed to help you conjure your inner dance diva, whether you're doing dishes in your kitchen or shaking your booty under the flashing lights of your favorite club. The internet buzz is that Annie will release an album of new material later this year, so we can look forward to more of her electropop creations.
I can't believe you read that.
Hey, everybody. This is Amanda. Julie's on a short podcast vacation, so today I've got Jeremy from our circulation department joining me. You'll hear his recommendation in just a minute, but first I want to tell you about my latest find. I like David Boreanaz. I liked him when he played Angel on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then continued the role on his own spin-off series. So I was really excited when I saw he was cast as a new character for the TV show Bones. This show follows the life of Temperance Bones Brennan, a forensic anthropologist who works at identifying human remains specifically from their bones. It's set in Washington, D.C. and has a great cast of characters. I just recently got caught up on most of the show's episodes now that the library has all three seasons on DVD. I have to say I enjoy them quite a bit, and not just because of FBI agent Celie Booth, played by Boreanaz. I really found myself liking Tempe. When I finally read the credits of the show and found out it was based on books by Kathy Rikes, I decided to give one of them a try, and what better place to start than at the very beginning. Rikes' debut novel, Deja Dead, introduces the world to Temperance Brennan. Bones the Book begins with Tempe working in her government lab in Montreal, Canada. She has yet to be nicknamed Bones, and I was a little disoriented at first because the characters I fell in love with from the TV show were all missing except for Tempe herself. The good news is that once you get reoriented, the story is just as gripping. Tempe is called to investigate some bones found in the city. She's convinced it's part of a string of murders committed by the same person, but the local police department isn't so sure. It's only when the killer targets Tempe herself that people start to listen. Published in 1997, this book was an interesting time capsule for technology. At one point, Tempe emailed her daughter and talked about sending the message with the same reverence she'd use for a flying car or something else magical. I had to pause and mentally teleport myself back to 1997 and remember that back then we didn't use email for everything like we do now. Ah, the good old days. Alrighty, well, I can't give away any more details without offending those nasty spoiler gods. Be warned, there is quite a bit of gore involved, but once you pick up this book, you're not going to want to put it down. Even if there's no David Boreanaz in it. So, Jeremy, what you reading?
Well, Amanda, I've got a fun, quick read from an award-winning author. Saying the title, The Very Persistent Gappers of Frib, is like speaking a foreign yet familiar language. Individually, the words seem to mean something, but spoken together, that meaning is obscured by the twists of one's tongue. But if author George Saunders intended to baffle readers with this short work, he did so only with the book's title. Once inside the world of Frib, things become much easier to understand and enjoy. Frip is a tiny village home to three families whose livelihood is based on the production of goat's milk and its various byproducts. That livelihood is threatened by gappers, orange, baseball-sized creatures that emerge from the sea and attach themselves to every goat in sight. One night, the gappers focus their attention on the goats belonging to a young girl named Capable, whose house is closest to the sea. Seeing their neighbor's misfortune, the other residents of Fripp become self-righteous and smug, claiming their gapper-free goats are a reward for being such good people. With her goats too frightened to produce milk, Capable appeals to her neighbors for help, but their response is the young girl doesn't deserve help because she doesn't work hard enough. Now, if this tale of a down-on-her-luck goat farmer sounds too simplistic to come from a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient like Saunders, then know this. Fripp is described as a kid's book for adults and an adult book for kids. This may be just a nice way of saying there are pictures, which are beautifully rendered by illustrator Lane Smith, but it's also an acknowledgement that people, no matter our age, still have a lot to learn about how to treat each other. In the simple language of a fairy tale, Saunders has Capable, who more than lives up to her name, teach us this lesson. When her neighbors eventually fall on hard times, Capable, now a successful fisherwoman, decides to help because she realizes, quote, "It's not all that much fun being the sort of person who eats a big dinner in a warm house while others shiver on their roofs in the dark." That's a simple idea, but adults tend to fuss with simple ideas until they're unintelligible. When it comes to our treatment of our neighbors, Saunders encourages us to ignore nuance and favor a simpler approach. It's a moral easy enough for any child to understand, but one too often lost on us grown-ups.
I can't believe you watched that.
The tagline to Arthur Penn's 1975 motion picture Night Moves states, maybe he would find the girl, maybe he would find himself. The he in the tagline refers to Private Eye Harry Mosby, played by Gene Hackman, in one of his best roles in this vastly underrated motion picture. Harry Mosby, ex-professional football player turned Private Eye, is hired by ex-B movie actress Arlene Iverson, played with slutty, drunken delight by Janet Ward, to find her runaway teenage daughter, Deli. In her film debut, Melanie Griffin plays the part of Deli. Simple, right? Well, not so fast. During this time, Harry finds out his wife, Ellen, is having an affair. William Barra once wrote in his book, The Great Movies, "A great film of intrigue and suspense must be complex." Granted, Night Moves' plot is complex, but what gives it that special edge is the complex characters. Harry Mosby's obsession is solving the case. It is also his tragedy. Harry's quest for the runaway leads him to Florida Keys, where he finds the girl, but there's more to it than meets the eye. Night Moves then begins to twist and turn, taking it to its unforgettable conclusion. Without giving anything away, the final 10 minutes in Night Moves is both suspenseful and tragic. It's brilliantly pieced together by the legendary film editor D.D. Allen. It's truly harrowing, and the final shot of the movie reflects Harry Mosby's state of being brilliantly. Night Moves is a tightly constructed thriller written by Alan Sharp. It is an intelligent film that does not talk down to its audience. So by all means, check it out. Clint, what are you watching?
I've rewatched a film by someone who I consider to be one of the greatest working filmmakers today, but also one of the most unknown. 2008 marked the 40th anniversary of the student riots in Paris throughout May of 1968. Though the revolution turned out to be a failure politically, the youthful idealism of the time did bring about a social change. Just like in the States, free love and the expanding of one's minds intellectually and chemically became the norm for the generation. The filmmaker that truly embodied the 68 spirit was Philip Garrel. Garrel made his first film 1 year earlier at the age of 19 and soon became known as the Arthur Rimbaud of cinema. In the following years, Garrel's insular allegories soon plummeted into the vast void that was left behind after the revolution. It took a stint in a mental institution, the kicking of his heroin addiction, and the dissolution of his 10-year relationship with the German chanteuse Nico for Garrel to finally fall back to the real world in 1979. The subsequent films became grounded in reality, autobiographical in nature, and obsessively strict to the structure of having a Nico and Garrel surrogate. He mostly stuck to this form until 2005 when he made Regular Lovers. "Enough repetition, move forward," is a line muttered by Regular Lovers' lead protagonist Francois, a loner poet that was much like Garrel at the time. This is the mindset that Garrel placed on himself, now a middle-aged man. In this instance, though, moving forward means going back to year zero, which for Garrel is May 1968. Considered by many a rebuttal to Bernardo Bertolucci's pathetic May 68 fantasy, The Dreamers, Gorel pinched the Italian filmmaker's costumes, and his leading man, who also happened to be Gorel's son, Louis, and with a fraction of the budget, made a three-hour ode to those children of Marx and Coca-Cola. Regular Lovers is a love story at heart, but you'd be hard-pressed to think that through the first hour. The main set piece of the first few reels is the Night of the Barricades, an infamous night that Gorel himself took part in that led to many arrests and the destruction of much public property. He films the scenes in such a simple and patient way that is the antithesis of how a Hollywood stooge would go about handling it. He zones in on the confusion and the boredom of the students as they wait for the imminent wave of the police force. It is on these front lines that Francois finally crosses paths with his object of desire, Lily, a sculptor who moonlights at a foundry to pay the bills. They become acquainted later at a party put on by Antoine, a trust fund baby whose home becomes a commune of sorts for the painters and poets and wannabe revolutionaries of the group. As with all idyllic settings, it is just a fleeting moment. Soon the eventual fact of necessary drift becomes too much, and the youthful factions crumble. People move away, and the love we thought we had does not conquer all, as Francois soon learns. Many take this as experience and move on, while others suffer underneath it. With its solo piano score and the high-contrast black-and-white photography from master cinematography William Luchansky, Regular Lovers harkens back to Gorel's love of silent cinema. The dialogue is perfunctory in nature, allowing for the faces of Gorel's ruminating men and the women who complement them to hang in the forefront like satellites orbiting an unknown planet. This planet being love, and how it saves us, yet also how it loses us once again. Regular Lovers is the first Gorel film to be released on DVD in the States. Luckily for us, Zeitgeist Films will be releasing two more of his films, I Can No Longer Hear the Guitar and Emergency Kisses, to DVD in May, which will go a long way in getting such a criminally underseen filmmaker into the limelight that he deserved. Now back to Bill for some info on the next movie at Maine.
Join us on Thursday, March 12th at 5:45 p.m. for another great Movies at Maine screening. This month's feature is Coma, a thriller based on a novel by Robin Cook, scripted and directed by the late Michael Crichton. Coma's cinematographer, Victor Kemper, introduces the film through a specially recorded interview. That's Thursday, March 12th, 5:45 p.m., at the Maine Library, downtown Nashville.
Hey, this is Brian. Yochum Pop? What? How's my Dutch pronunciation? If you know the proper way to pronounce Speedy J's real name, we want to know. We also want to know what you think of the Popmatic podcast. What do you like the most? What do you want more of? What do you want less of? Give us a shout at my email address, brian.n.jones@nashville.gov. That's brian.n.jones@nashville.gov. Maybe we'll give you some love next month via the interwebs. Out.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Popmatic Podcast. For more information, please visit library.nashville.org.
That's on the interweb.